Iran signs a memorandum for permanent membership at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, opening a new chapter in its relations with the regional body. A special UN rapporteur says overcompliance with unilateral sanctions hinders the delivery of humanitarian aid, urging all states to eliminate or minimize it. And the UN chief warns that the prospects for peace in Ukraine are minimal, adding that even a ceasefire is not in sight. Hello and welcome to World News. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran's foreign minister says he has signed a memorandum on Tehran's permanent membership at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Hossein Amir Abdollahian says the country now enters a new phase of diverse economic, trade, transit and energy cooperation with the organization. According to Iran's top diplomat, the Secretary General of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization has congratulated Iran on its full accession to the organization. Amir Abdollahian is accompanying Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, who is in the Uzbek city of Samarkand, to attend the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit on Friday. Iran's foreign minister says the Islamic Republic considers its borders with Armenia as a historical communication route that should be preserved without change. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remark during a phone call with his Azeri counterpart, Jehun Bayramov. The top Iranian diplomat exchanged views on the latest development in the South Caucasian region and expressed concern over clashes between Yerevan and Baku. He said Iran supports the full territorial integrity of both nations. He called on both sides to remain patient and try to find a diplomatic solution to the problems. Amir Abdollahian said Tehran is ready to meditate such negotiations. Azerbaijan's foreign minister, for his part, said that Baku does not have its eye on any country's territories. A UN special rapporteur has slammed the US unilateral sanctions and the overcompliance with the measures for having negative impact on populations of sanction-hit countries. Alina Duhan made the remarks during a session at the Geneva-based Human Rights Council. Duhan noted that overcompliance with the unilateral sanctions also hinders the delivery of humanitarian aid to the people in need, urging all states to eliminate or minimize it by appropriate means. Addressing the session, Iran's top human rights official Kazem Gharibabadi said the Iranian people are the main victims of unilateral, inhumane, coercive measures that have been imposed by the US.
Iranian people are the main innocent victims of the inhumane unilateral coercive measures that have been imposed against them under the failed so-called policy of maximum pressure, which is designed and implemented as a means of war to commit crimes against humanity, persecution and genocide against our people.
Gharibabadi stressed that the unilateral sanctions are in flagrant violation of the principles of the rule of law, the UN Charter and the international law. He said that sanctions are targeting banking, transport and insurance sectors. Our reasons, Iran is unable to access much needed medical equipment and supplies. He said the curbs have inflicted irreparable damage on the country's health system. The UN Secretary General warns that the prospects of peace in Ukraine are, quote, minimal, adding that even a ceasefire is not in sight. Antonio Guterres issued the warning following a phone conversation with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Guterres said it would be naive to believe there has been sufficient progress towards a rapid end to the war in Ukraine. The UN chief added that he was maintaining contact with both sides. He expressed hope that one day it would be possible to go to a higher level of discussion. The Russia-Ukraine war started in late February. Moscow says the war will end once Kiev meets its demands, including never applying to join NATO. Thousands of people have lost their lives as a result of the Ukraine war, while millions have been displaced. A surprise national holiday in the UK for the funeral of the Queen Elizabeth II has created chaos among the people across the country. Authorities declared national mourning after the death of the Queen last week. They have announced a complete shutdown on Monday, the day she will be laid to rest. The announcement has frustrated ordinary citizens as they face the cancellation of their appointments with doctors and the National Health Service. Many poor Britons are panicked over the closure of food banks. A range of other economic activities are also grinding to a halt. Grocery stores, restaurants and cinemas and other entertainment would remain closed on the day of the funeral. Air travel is expected to be impacted as well. London's Heathrow Airport has warned of disruption to flights as the Queen's coffin will be carried through the capital.
King Charles III proclaimed after 73 years. His life is a complicated story. From his hatred of school as a child, to his high-profile marriage to and divorce from his former wife, Princess Diana, to his affair with his now wife and queen consort, Camilla Parks Owens. Those who believe in him say he put his time to good use, that he'll do well in his role as the monarch. Others say the king is faced with huge challenges. At home, he's facing growing anti-monarchy sentiment as the country grapples with the worst cost of living crisis in decades. Calls from Republicans who say the monarchy is classist, expensive, and outdated.
Are we really now in a place in 21st century Britain where a new head of state is proclaimed, we're told to accept this person without any question?
There's also his relationship with the devolved nations, such as Northern Ireland, with whom the monarchy has had a complicated history, not forgotten by those who bore the brunt of it.
There will never be an acceptance of the monarchy here in Ireland. There's been too much history, too much has been done in the name of the monarchy in Ireland for the Irish people to ever be conscious of that ever happening again.
In Scotland, where the Queen died, independence remains at the center of political debate. The death of Queen Elizabeth II has also revived the debate about the future and unity of the British Commonwealth, a group of 15 independent countries that recognize the British monarch as their head of state.
We've already seen many calls across the Commonwealth for the removal of those particular countries to be removed from the Commonwealth. I think that's going to be something that is going to be at the top of the agenda over the next couple of years.
Constitutionally, the monarch should be seen and not heard from on contentious issues. King Charles is known to not shy away from expressing his views on a range of topics, such as the environment, new laws, and more. He says he won't do it as sovereign. His critics see it differently.
The new king starts his job in different circumstances than his mother did. An increasing number of Britons are questioning the privileged position of the royal family. The Commonwealth looks set to unravel, and the union of the United Kingdom looks uncertain. Will King Charles III be the last UK monarch? Saipur is up, London.
In other news, Sweden's Prime Minister concedes defeat after a four-party right-wing bloc won the majority of parliamentary seats in Sunday's election. With a handful of votes remain to be counted, Magdalena Andersson said the results showed the right bloc had won. The right-wing bloc includes anti-immigration Sweden Democrats, which was once shunned by all political parties but now has over 20% of the vote. The leader of the moderate party, Ulf Kristersson, is the right's candidate to be prime minister. He faces a number of challenges. Sweden is in the middle of a cost of living crisis and could be heading for a recession next year. The war in Ukraine has also destabilized the Baltic region, which Sweden considers its backyard. There is still uncertainty as to whether Turkey will finally agree to Stockholm's application for NATO membership. People have attended a conference in Gaza to condemn the Oslo Peace Accords, signed in 1993. Palestinians consider the accords as a major setback for Palestinians and even worse than the Balfour Declaration of 1917, which helped create the Israeli regime on the occupied Palestinian land. Ashraf Shannon brings us more details in the following report.
Palestinians have held a national conference to mark 29 years since the signing of the Oslo Accords. Hundreds of people attended the conference, demanding the cancellation of the agreements. In September 1993, the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, signed the Oslo Accords with the Israeli regime on the lawn of the White House in Washington, D.C. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas asserted the failure of the Oslo Accords and called on the Palestinian Authority to withdraw its recognition of the Israeli regime.
As we mark the 29th anniversary of the ill-fated Oslo Accords, we call upon the Palestinian Authority to withdraw from the Oslo Accords and to cancel its recognition of the Israeli regime. Today, we also salute the Palestinian resistance, who managed to liberate the Gaza Strip in 2005. Armed resistance is the key to the liberation of all of Palestine.
The Oslo Accords were meant to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but nearly three decades later, Palestinians consider them as a bad chapter in their history. Attendees slammed the Oslo Accords and expressed their support to resistance against the Israeli regime.
The Zionist enemy will never respect any peace agreements and only understands the language of force. We're here to support armed resistance against the Zionist enemy.
Senior officials attending the conference called on all Palestinians to unite their ranks and adhere to armed resistance against the Israeli occupation.
The Oslo Accords were a stab in the back of the Palestinian people. The Zionist regime is a cancer in the region and it must be removed. All forms of resistance must be used against Zionist forces, and armed resistance is the key to defeat the Zionist occupation.
Observers say the Oslo Accords have only brought calamities to Palestinians and have failed to secure the creation of an independent Palestinian state.
29 years on, Palestinians say that peace accords will not free their land, and it's only armed resistance which will help them regain their rights. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A fast-growing wildfire is spreading in the U.S. state of California, threatening a number of small foothill communities northeast of Sacramento. Officials say the mosquito fire has burned nearly 24,000 hectares. It has forced the evacuation of some 11,000 people in a number of communities between Sacramento and Lake Tahoe. California authorities say the fire grew by more than 1,200 hectares overnight and containment dropped from 25% to 20%. Drought and rugged terrain have created prime conditions for the fire to spread quickly. Smoke from the fire has worsened air quality, forcing schools and colleges in neighboring state of Nevada to close. The California fire has already claimed several lives and destroyed many buildings. Millions of people have converged in the holy cities in Iraq to take part in Arbaeen ceremonies. Arbaeen marks 40 days since Imam Hussein's martyrdom anniversary. We will look at this issue in this edition of Hashtag Trending.
Hey everyone, welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. Millions of pilgrims from different countries have converged on the Iraqi city of Karbala to show their love and devotion to Imam Hussein. The pilgrims brave extremely hot weather to walk to the holy shrines in Karbala and Najaf. The walk is a good occasion for pilgrims to show their unfathomable love for Imam Hussein. It's also a great chance to show unity among Muslims from different countries. Social media users have taken to Twitter to show their reaction to the ongoing event. We're going to start with our first batch of tweets with this one by Sayyida Zainab. She wrote, "The biggest message of Arbaeen is the universality of Islam because Arbaeen has processions and pilgrims from all over the world. Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, India, Thailand, Afghanistan, Kuwait, and so on." Tabish Abbas Patan has our next tweet. "The processions of Arbaeen, which are attended by millions of people, are reflective of people's attempt to engage in self-purification, self-discipline, and the reformation of the society. In short, they are an exercise to be good soldiers for Imam Mahdi, Ajalallah, hashtag Arbaeen 2022. Ishaq Arfi said, "Arba'in's walk journey of love continues as Zawar pilgrims of Imam Hussein alayhi salam march toward the holy city of Karbala, hashtag Arba'in 2022. Millions of Iranian pilgrims are also traveling to Iraq to take part in the Arba'in walk, and the huge number of Iranian pilgrims and the hospitality of Iraqis towards the Iranian pilgrims have provided a good chance to highlight the cultural and religious commonalities between the two countries. Let's move on to our second batch of tweets. The first one comes from Zulfaqar al-Iraqi. Iraqi soldier carrying an elderly Iranian visitor on the Arba'in walk. Hosnia has our next tweet. She wrote, "These days, Saudi trolls are doing their best to disrupt the Arba'in walk by creating division and enmity between Iran and Iraq." Our next tweet comes from Mansour Ali Khandro. He said, "An estimated over 1,000 pilgrims per hour are entering borders through Iran-Iraq. The Arba'in walk is not merely a walk. It is a rallying cry in support of the oppressed, weak, and powerless. This unique ceremony is also a chance to celebrate peace and harmony among people from different nations." Now let's move on to our final batch of tweets for the day. Our first one comes from Kazim Abbas Rezvi. He said, "Almost 20 million Shias converge on Karbala, Iraq, each year for Arba'in, many on foot from across Iraq, Iran, and abroad. According to sources, this year, millions of pilgrims will go to gather in Karbala on Arba'in, making it the world's largest annual human gathering." Spring NM has our next tweet. "The Arba'in walk, the world's largest peace rally where people of all faiths coexist in harmony, love, and beauty." We have another photo shared by Samantha. She said, "Arba'in walk is the best exhibition of world peace." Moving on to our final tweet of the day, coming from Fatima T. She wrote, "Culture of Arba'in walk is the culture of the unseen world. It's not experience to see poor people of a country save for 1 year to serve pilgrims, to see people just want to give away. It's all for love of Hussein, grandson of the Prophet Muhammad." And that's a wrap for another edition of Hashtag Trending. Take care and bye-bye.
Well, those were the top stories for this hour. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight. The New York judge overseeing a tax fraud case against the Trump Organization on Monday, 12th of September, rejected any effort to delay next month's trial, acknowledging concerns that the former president, Donald Trump's company, might be trying to stall the criminal case. The judge cautioned against delaying tactics and said the trial will begin on 24th of October. Please stay with us for more details. ABC News has covered the story and has this to say. It's starting to look like the Trump Organization is trying to stall its upcoming criminal trial in New York until after the midterm elections, a judge said on Monday, 12th of September, during a pre-trial hearing. Former President Donald Trump's family real estate firm is scheduled to start trial on 24th of October for fraud and tax evasion. We are not delaying the start of the trial, Judge Juan Merchan said on Monday, 12th of September. A prosecutor, Joshua Steinglass, had accused attorneys for the Trump Organization of gamesmanship by failing to disclose the names of expert witnesses the defense will call to testify, as required under the rules of discovery. The name of the game has been delay, Joshua Steinglass said. Defense attorney Susan Neschels said she was sandbagged by the accusation and explained that the defense's approach to the case had changed after last month's guilty plea by longtime Trump Organization chief financial officer Alan Weisselberg. Weisselberg pleaded guilty last month to all 15 counts in an indictment that accused him of failing to pay taxes on nearly $2 million in fringe benefits the Trump Organization allegedly paid him, off the books. As part of his plea deal, he agreed to testify against the Trump Organization in next month's trial. We are now restructuring our defense, Susan Neschels said. This is all a result of Mr. Weisselberg's pleading guilty. The case against the Trump Organization is dramatically strengthened by the guilty plea, Steinglass claimed. The judge gave the defense until next Monday to provide the names of the experts they would call to testify, what they would testify to, and how that testimony is relevant to the case. The judge also told the defense not to make arguments to the jury that imply the company was charged by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office merely because it is owned by the former president. No selective prosecution, Judge Merchant said, adding he would also preclude arguments at trial that suggest this is a novel prosecution. Those are not defences, Judge Merchant said. I will have very little patience at trial. The trial is expected to last about a month. Alan Weisselberg's plea agreement contains no requirements for a long-time chief financial officer to cooperate in the criminal fraud case against Donald Trump himself, which is separate from the case against the Trump Organization. Reuters news agency has also reported on the same story, but giving us more details. The New York judge overseeing a tax fraud case against the Trump Organization on Monday rejected any effort to delay the trial, acknowledging concerns that former President Donald Trump's company might be trying to stall the criminal case. At a pretrial hearing in a New York State court in Manhattan, Justice Juan Merchan warned against delaying tactics, even as a Trump Organization lawyer said the decision by longtime chief financial officer Alan Weisselberg to plead guilty changed how the defense will present its case. One of the accusations is the defense is trying to stall, Judge Juan Merchan said. It's starting to feel that way a little bit. I'm repeating, we are not delaying this trial. It's starting on 24th of October and we're going forward. Prosecutors charged Trump's company and Alan Weisselberg in July 2021 with scheming to defraud, tax fraud, and falsifying business records for awarding off-the-book perks to senior executives. The Trump Organization, which manages golf clubs, hotels, and other real estate around the world, has pleaded not guilty and faces possible fines and other penalties if convicted. Alan Weisselberg initially pleaded not guilty, but changed his plea on 18th of August and agreed to testify, though he is not cooperating with prosecutors' larger probe into Donald Trump himself. His plea agreement calls for a five-month jail sentence. Judge Juan Merchan also said he will not let the Trump Organization argue to jurors that it was a victim of selective prosecution by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, now led by Democrat Alvin Bragg. Susan Neschels, a lawyer for the company, said Alan Weisselberg felt he was being targeted because of his ties to the Republican former president. "I believe that he will say that he thinks he was targeted because of his association with Donald Trump and pleaded guilty in part from concerns that the targeting would continue and he would be unfairly punished," Neschels said. Susan Neschels also said Alan Weisselberg told prosecutors that no one other than himself and Trump Organization controller Jeffrey McConney, who was immune from prosecution, knew about the tax wrongdoing. "He has no knowledge of former President Trump knowing anything about it or any of the other Trumps," Neschels said. Assistant District Attorney Joshua Steinglass disputed her characterization of Weisselberg's discussion with prosecutors. Nicholas Gravanti, a lawyer for Alan Weisselberg, declined to comment. Donald Trump has not been charged or accused of wrongdoing in this case. Outside of the courtroom, Susan Neschels took issue with any suggestion of a stall. The trial is expected to last about 4 weeks. "I'm not stalling," Susan Neschels said. "I'm ready for trial."
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program, The Muslim Lady. This is your host, Zainab, and I have with me Siddiqa. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
A very warm welcome, Siddiqa.
Thank you very much.
Dear listeners, Siddiqa is a student of jurisprudence in the Hawza Ilmi of Qom, and she's also a researcher. She researches a lot on the issues related to women. So here we are to discuss another issue, that's abortion. All right, Siddiqa, in our previous sessions, we are talking about abortion, different forms. Now, I want to ask you, there's something called as honor killing in the Asian countries, especially, wherein you see a female, she was involved in a relationship, or she was raped, or which the family was not lying, or they were not they actually didn't want their dignity to go down and all, especially the rape cases. So when this female is pregnant with a child, they try to abort the child and name it as honor killing. What does Islam say on that?
So basically, in some countries, like you rightly mentioned, a woman is given very few rights in herself. And if, for example, for God forbid, a rape were to occur, she would be killed as part of an honor killing program to save the honor of the family, while the man is let go without much consequences. Now, if the woman in this, in such a case, were to become pregnant, and her, and if she doesn't, if anyone finds out, then there's a possibility of her being killed for a crime she did not commit. Now, some scholars, and I stress on the term some over here.
Okay.
Some scholars would say because her own life is in danger, and bringing this child into this world would bring exceedingly difficult circumstances and would be very harmful to her. Therefore, before ensoulment, they could be
allowed to go for abortion.
They could be allowed to go for abortion. Oh, here again, I stress the term some, because some would give, say, you know, if there are other ways, such as giving the child up for adoption or going through other agencies.
Alternatives.
Other alternatives.
Okay.
Then it wouldn't be permissible. Sorry. So yes, and some scholars would say in these cases where it would bring exceedingly difficult circumstances for the woman herself for a crime she did not commit and was forced
into it. She can go for abortion,
Before ensoulment. Okay. Which today's world, it's quite easy to recognize that a woman is pregnant. I think within 6 weeks, within 5 weeks, she can easily find out.
Yeah.
That she's pregnant.
And sometimes even before that.
Correct. So today we have a lot of technology at hand to be able to come to a conclusion of what exactly is happening.
Yeah.
And so that the right choices can be made before it gets too late.
Oh, well, let me ask you again. So what is the actual time in Islam when the soul enters a body?
Generally, they keep it at around 20 weeks.
Okay.
Which is just around 5 months.
So you're trying to say if women goes for abortion before these 20 weeks, some scholars say it's okay, she can.
In extraordinary circumstances where her life or the life of the child would be in danger.
Not like always.
It's not an absolute rule that a woman is allowed to go for abortion, absolute rule. It's not an absolute rule at all.
Even if it's before 20 weeks.
Yes, even if it's before 20 weeks, if it's a viable, safe, healthy pregnancy with no harm to the mother, and it's just unwanted, therefore it doesn't, because just want does not define the laws. Islam does not look at what I want, what you want.
Okay.
There is a set of rights and a set of rules we need to abide by. Because if there were no rules and rights that we were allowed to abide by, we would each be transgressing the other person's rights.
Exactly, like because you're looking at your own rights, you're not looking at the right to life that this fetus has. Yeah.
Yes, and Islam does not take that.
And see how this is the beauty of Islam. A fetus that is not even 20 weeks old, Islam gives it a right to life.
Islam gives its own right, not only even the right to life, they even have the right to inheritance.
Wow.
When I was looking through the rights of inheritance as part of my course, it's very extensive as to how Islam would even take into account if there were, in those days when obviously, right now, it's just been maybe 10, 20, 30 odd years that we have sonographies in place where we can see what gender, how many children are present. But before this technology was present, Islam would take into account if they're two males or if they're twins in the womb. And for every circumstance, there's a rule, even an inheritance. So Islam gives absolute right to every, I'm going to use the term human being here.
Okay.
Because that fetus is also a viable human being. It has that capacity to become a human being, even if it is termed as fetus or zygote or...
All right. These rulings are in itself so interesting. We'd like to know more. After a short break, dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back. I'm with Sadiqa and we're discussing different forms of abortion, where it's allowed, where it's not allowed. So we're talking about rape. If a woman is raped, in what circumstances she's allowed to go for abortion and in what circumstances she's not. You said some of the scholars, you used the term some. Some allow it before the ensoulment and before a soul is entered into the body. under certain conditions, and some say you should go for alternatives.
Yes. And then we have other issues, right? Now, we've looked at the issue of rape. But then right now, because we have technology at hand, we're even able to find out if a child has issues in their growth, okay. Right? So some children would have very intensive issues, malformations, deformation, and bringing the child into this world would bring excessive hardship for the mother.
And for the child himself.
And for the child as well. And in some cases, they have issues that are not very severe. Okay. They do bring a level of difficulty, but they're not severe. Now, for both of these cases, again, they're different rulings. Like, for example, when it comes to deformation in the child's growth, and it would bring excessive hardship for the mother and the child, scholars like Ayatollah Makarem Shirazi, who's one of the jurists in Qom,
yeah.
He says that before ensoulment, again, you can abort. Okay. Again, we're talking about excessive harm over here. It would bring difficulty. But then there are other issues like Down syndrome.
Okay.
We can easily find out if a child has Down syndrome these days, right? Yeah. There's a lot of these tests
available that shows you.
These tests are readily available and mothers can choose to go through them. Now, the problem with Down syndrome tests as well is even the technology is there, it's not sometimes 100% definite. Like, I remember when I was pregnant with my child, I wanted to take this test. So I went to my doctor and she was like, look, I've had cases where the results were not correct. And when the child came, the child didn't have Down syndrome.
All right.
Right? So where there's no certainty whether the child is going to have it because the tests were not absolutely conclusive, you can't just go and abort the child. Now, let's say it's conclusive the child has Down syndrome. Now, what do they do? Down syndrome is difficult. But then the world we live in today as well has a lot of services for these children as well. Given that Down syndrome allows a person to live their life relatively comfortably and does not bring excessive harm. Here, again, I'm stressing on the word excessive. Then scholars like Ayatollah Hadawi Tehrani, who is again in Qom, says, no, you can't abort. So again,
if a child is suffering from that Down syndrome.
Yes, he does not allow abortion in that case, given that it is not excessive harm, right?
It's not excessive.
Yeah. So again, there's a case-by-case basis in everything. Giving a blanket rule would not be wise because every case has to be looked at and then the correct rules have to be applied to it.
All right. So Islam does not have blind rules to apply for all the cases. Every different case has a different ruling.
Yes.
For itself.
We do have some general rulings like excessive harm, right to life. In the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about we do not place upon a soul more than what it can hold. We do not give it more than what it has its capacity to hold.
Yeah.
Right? So these verses are used when it comes to deducting a law.
Okay.
Right? Or the mother should not bear the hardships of its child.
All right. We'll discuss more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio. Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. I'm with Sadiqa and we're talking on abortion. Yes, Sadiqa, you told us different cases. You're saying that Islam does not have a single set of rule for abortion. It looks at abortion in a multidimensional way as per the case.
Exactly. So we have, like we discussed, there's a safe, viable pregnancy with no harms, abortion is not allowed. If there is danger to a mother, either through honor killings or having that pregnancy would generally harm her life, then in those cases, they would be allowed to abort the child before ensoulment. And then what about if the child has deformities? Again, how excessive, how intensive are those deformities? Are they very bad that they would bring excessive harm on the mother and the child? In which case they do allow abortion. But if it's not going to bring excessive harm, like Down syndrome, and again, these we have to have certainty that the child has Down syndrome. And let's say they do have certainty, but given that there are a lot of services today, and children with Down syndrome do go on to live relatively normal lives, even though they do require support, but given that they do go ahead to live relatively normal lives.
And Islam, it's not an excessive harm?
Yeah, it doesn't bring excessive harm. Islam gives them that right to live that life.
And you said that there are certain scholars who do not allow, even if the conclusion of the test is that the child is suffering with the...
Yeah, they do not allow at all, given that it is not excessive harm. And that the child needs to be given the right to life and the right to continue the journey to this world, basically. And the journey to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because in Islam, the aim of every person in this world is to reach Allah in whatever capacity we can. And there's no blanket method. It's not a blanket ruling that you have to reach Allah only if you are completely mentally and emotionally stable. Each person is judged by their own, by what capacity Allah has given them, even if it is with Down syndrome.
Yeah, like Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in Holy Quran, like, we'll be testing you, or will be, we expect from you only the capacity, as per the capacity you have to hold on over these things. Thank you so much, Sadiqa, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, fi amanallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The racist roots of American and European universities are being exposed and their nasty implications in human misery publicized for the whole world to see, says Hamid Debashi, author, in an article published under the heading, Western Universities Struggle to Grow Away from Their Racist Roots. Stay tuned for more. Last April, Harvard President Larry Baitow released the report of the Committee on Harvard and Legacy of Slavery, accepted the committee's recommendations in full, and announced a historic commitment of $100 million to fund their implementation, according to a detailed internal report on the school's four-century connection to slavery. This seems to be a season of public penance for American universities as they come to terms with nasty skeletons in their closets. How can a university muster the moral authority to teach anyone anything with that kind of horrid past? The report by a committee of Harvard faculty members is Harvard's effort to begin redressing the wrongs of the past, as some other universities have been doing for decades, according to an article in the New York Times. But how exactly is this redressing to be done? When people heard John Henry Newman's lofty ideas in 1850s, later collected in the volume The Idea of a University, they might be forgiven for thinking that Europeans and Americans were truly engaged in the perfection of the human soul, and that universities were a place to cultivate young people for an upright moral life. Really? Enslaved men and women served Harvard presidents and professors in fed and cared for Harvard students, the Harvard Report reveals. Was that evidence of Newman's ideas reaching the New World? The racist roots of American and European universities are being exposed and their nasty implications in human misery publicized for the whole world to see. This is not a cause for jubilation or even for a sigh of relief that truth is finally triumphing. This is a moment for reflection and an opportunity for remedy. The structural issues such as reports that expose for the next generations of higher education. At least since the reflections of the towering Italian thinker Antonio Gramsci, we have known that education is a solid source of cultural hegemony of the ruling class. But the relatively widespread availability of higher education and the attraction of a global body of students to US and European universities has demographically altered their compositions. A much larger and more diverse body of students, faculty, and administration is now attentive to the roots and fruits of these universities. This cycle of soul-searching began some two decades ago with Brown University examining its roots in slavery. Soon afterwards, Harvard College acknowledged it had relied on slave labor, and Princeton University admitted to holding a slave auction in 1766. At University of Columbia, sons of merchants involved in the slave trade were enrolled, while Dartmouth College admitted that at one time there had been arguably as many enslaved black people as there were students. Death was at a time when University of Pennsylvania faculty and alumni were actively involved in framing the Constitution to support slavery. European universities were not exempt. Oxford began probing its own role in British colonialism in 2019 in what The Guardian described as a pioneering effort to crowdsource and decolonize its own imperialist part. This led to the establishment of an informed and informative website detailing the history of Oxford's racist roots in slavery and colonialism. These events at Oxford started with a student-led movement that originated in South Africa called Rhodes Must Fall, a reference to Cecil Rhodes, Oxford's imperialist benefactor. But Oxford ultimately decided to keep its Rhodes statue intact because it would have been too expensive to remove it. Other UK universities are equally implicated. The University of Glasgow admitted it had received more than $258 million from people who derived their wealth from slavery, while the University of Bristol estimated that 85% of the wealth used to found the university depended on slave labor, according to Reuters. On both sides of the Atlantic, U.S. and European universities were founded on the profits made from transatlantic slave trade and the lucrative business of colonialism. In these universities, the children of slave traders and colonial officers were educated, and indeed indoctrinated, in the validity of their conquest and in the political culture and moral depravity that sustained this sick tradition. What do we do now? Admitting mea culpa is, of course, necessary but not sufficient. Revelations that top American and universities in the Europe were heavily invested in slavery, benefited from the slave trade, and were institutional advocates of colonialism is a major event in the history of higher education. But what exactly needs to be done once such revelations are widely publicized? Allocation of resources to diversify the student and faculty body to include the descendants of the impoverished, robbed, and denigrated communities, Black people, Native Americans, Latins, and students and faculty from across the colonial world is, of course, an absolute must. While Western universities are today quite cognizant of the disenfranchised communities in their midst and seek to recruit more from these communities, this does not apply to students from around the world subject to their colonial and imperial violence. This is a serious shortcoming. Students and scholars from Asia, Africa, and Latin America, where the EU and US have been definitive to their national miseries, must be given particular attention. Today, Afghan and Iraqi students in particular need to be given financial resources for their higher education in American and European universities. But what exactly are these students and scholars to study or teach in these universities? Further indoctrination in white supremacist curricula. The urgent task of remedying the horrors of the past must include serious reconsideration of the future of college curricula. Meaningful reparations can only occur when the history of racism, slavery, and colonialism is brought to the forefront inside European and American university classrooms. But today, even the body of scholarship produced under the rubric of critical race theory or intersectionality is under attack by reactionary forces in Europe and the US. Private universities, at the mercy of political pressure, could never lead the way, except within the conservative context determined by their wealthy donors, which continue to oppose any serious curricular changes. This is where the global media is an equally, if not even more, changes. This is where the global media is an equal, if not even more crucial, public sphere where such changes can be inaugurated. Consider when the New York Times launched two crucial projects, the 1619 Project on the History of Slavery and the Haiti Ransom Project on French colonialism in Haiti. To be sure, these two seminal projects are based on generations of scholarship. But such a scholarship does not easily translate into curricular changes. Western civilization continues to be the code word for the sustained indoctrination of successive generations of students who are kept critically unaware, not just of other civilizations, but also of the troubling origins of civilizational thinking. Nothing enduring or significant follows so long as we have curricular apartheid in the world, with Western civilization receiving preferential treatment and enormous resources, while other civilizations, cultures, and accompanying suffering are delegated to the poorly financed periphery. Today, issues of environmental justice, mass refugees, labor migration, and the organically changing character of world cultures are far more crucial to understand than a fake and forced emphasis on Western civilization. Today, the most racist white supremacist political movements are sustained and agitated by false assumptions about the uniqueness and superiority of Western civilization, to which elite universities remain committed. There is no redressing the sustained history of U.S. and European universities' involvement with the slavery, racism, and colonialism without first dismantling its sustained ideological premise.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.